The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning to you all. This is Richard Martin with the Monday edition of the Wake Up Call, coming to you from Singapore, hopefully drying out after one of the wettest spells in its history, certainly in living memory. And I should explain that the date is the 19th of July, for those who are interested in such things, and that we are coming to you through the PRN studios in New York City. Well, it seems to me that we suffer from a massive oversupply of what I'd describe as tired old ideas, which have long since become useless. And also, there seems to be a complete absence of new pragmatic ideas which could be founded on the present and near-term future. In terms of supply and demand, we face a complete oversupply of wretched concepts which have failed for fundamental reasons. And we seem to be left with a strong unmet demand for new pragmatic ideas based on the present realities. At the risk of stating the obvious, which actually isn't obvious at all in the current politics of experience, if any of these tired old ideas had retained any utility, they would already have worked. If stimulus via central state borrowing and spending had been the solution to what they call the Great Recession, it would have worked by now. Instead, the private economy continues to shrink, and many will argue that we need another couple of years of the save and borrow and spend to create private demand. But this is actually fundamentally flawed thinking. Private demand is intrinsically hobbled by two factors. Firstly, the bottom 80% of consumers are over-indebted and have few assets or little surplus income to leverage into more consumption. And then, the 75% of U.S. households who are above the poverty line already own everything anyone could possibly need for a wonderful, fulfilled lifestyle. And that, you see, is the dirty little secret, not just of what passes for capitalism today. Demand for more stuff and services is actually as endless, beneficial, and fulfilling as the relentless media marketing machine would have us believe. The connection between ever-rising consumption and individual happiness is actually weak to non-existent. Beyond a rather modest level, such as for clean water, a warm place to sleep, and sufficient calories to eat, etc., the factors which leverage human happiness and fulfillment are relationships, such as family, friends, work colleagues, etc., and also meaningful work. So the explicit premise that private demand for more consumption is the foundation of prosperity, and that all we need to do is lavish enough money on consumers to spark their insatiable appetite for more, more, more of anything and everything, is doubly bankrupt. There are limits on private organic demand, that is, demand which isn't created by giving everyone $3,000 to buy a new car, etc., both financially. In other words, most American households having too much debt and not enough surplus income and or assets to justify more borrowing and splurging. And intrinsically, another 1,000 songs on your iPod, another pair of shoes, another session at the nail salon, none of this actually adds much to human fulfillment or happiness. Beyond a modest level, consumption is the classic example of diminishing returns. You know, you keep spending more and more, but enjoying less and less. At the end, ennui, alienation, and exhaustion replace enjoyment. An addictive cycle of consumption, dissatisfaction, and a derangement devoid of self-awareness takes hold. Indeed, it can be argued that the entire economy of consumption is more a systemic cultivation of addiction than a system based on fulfilling human needs and the pursuit of happiness. So many proponents of the current thinking refer back to the 1930s as the testing field for their solution of fiscal and quantitative stimulus, which is basically the easing of interest rates and availability of credit. Yet so many fundamental factors today didn't exist in the 1930s. For example, global wage arbitrage was not much of a factor then, and it certainly is a key determinant of U.S. household income now. The U.S. will live or die economically through the ability to create real products and services with a high market value in the global market. Otherwise, U.S. wages will inexorably trend to the wage levels in lower value producers. You can borrow and spend all you want, but if incomes are declining for structural reasons, along with assets deflating from credit bubbles, then you are achieving nothing more than shoveling sand to hold back the tide. Rising debt loads require rising incomes. Without rising incomes, rising debt leads to insolvency. That is obvious, yet it is not something our thinking geniuses can admit, lest their entire project be revealed as intrinsically flawed. In the 1930s, the federal government and the household held very modest levels of debt. Thus, a borrow and spend frenzy to fund a global war, i.e. World War II, was possible because the borrowing began from a very low basis. Before the 1929 stock market crash, federal regulation of the financial industry was light to non-existent. Thus, a move as simple as guaranteeing savings deposits in banks, the FDIC, had enormous leverage because it filled a void. If additional regulation could have fixed the U.S. economy at a fundamental level, it would have already done so. It hasn't. And the reason is marginal returns. In the 1930s, tens of thousands of people were put to productive work for very modest sums of money, even when adjusted for inflation. Now, politically influential unions and private contractors kill off any large-scale work projects, demanding instead that repairing roads and things like that go to private corporations seeking hefty profits and union labor, which costs $100,000 or more per worker. This is how we reach the absurdity that the federal stimulus package has supposedly saved thousands of jobs at an average cost of $323,000 per job. That's the consequence of increasingly marginal returns, ladies and gentlemen. The Keynesian expansionist idea worked well from a basis of near zero government debt and public spending, which was so modest in cost that every dollar was highly leveraged. Mike Shedlock recently wrote an article about what he called Stimulus Checkup, 100 Ridiculous Projects Funded by the American Recovery Act. And he noted, and I quote, Obama creates 640,329 jobs at a cost of $323,739.83 per job. So in an economy with 131 million jobs and 150 million workers, then a $778 billion Keynesian stimulus project has created or saved less than 0.5% of the nation's jobs. That is a horrendously marginal return. And finally, the Keynesian idea has failed, because the central state has taken over such a large share of developed nations' incomes and GDP The U.S. government has borrowed and spent trillions of dollars in so-called prosperity, supporting a global empire and various forms of crony capitalism and cartels, monopoly capital and protected state fiefdoms, prison guard unions, sick care cartels, defense contractors, etc. The amount of leverage offered by another $1 trillion or so for a state which spends $3.5 trillion is marginal. If quantitative easing had indeed been the solution for what ails the U.S. economy and its parasitic, supremely politically powerful financial industry, it would already have worked. If lowering the taxes of the top 1% of households and dropping the tax rates on speculative income while leaving the rates on productive income quite high could have actually created widespread prosperity via the trickle-down theory, it would have done so already. It hasn't. So that scheme, so dear to the hearts and pocketbooks of the politicians, has failed completely and utterly. Income disparity has leapt, and while the productive high-income earners pay most of the taxes, the unproductive financial parasites reaping speculative gains via gaming the system and fraud pay a mere 15% on their $600 million per year so-called earnings. Very depressing. All right. Here I come with my information, ladies and gentlemen. My name is still Richard Martin, has been for many decades, and hopefully will continue to be so. Richard Martin of the Wake Up Call. The number to call, the toll-free number to talk to me and others, hopefully, who might call in and want to strike up a conversation, is 888-874-4888. Repeat once more, 888-874-4888. That's the toll-free number. Please call in at any time. I am always ready, willing, and able to take your calls, and I look forward to them with bated breath. If, on the other hand, you are of a retiring nature and wish to post your questions, comments, rants, etc. on the Internet, you may do so by emailing me at rm@gfawd.com. That's once again RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And as always, please feel free at any time to call me in private on my direct line through Sarasota, Florida, at area code 941-441-1682. That's once again 941-441-1682. That's my direct line in Singapore through Sarasota, Florida. Well, you know, the level of propaganda is so pervasive that few citizens seem to grasp the extent to which the two political parties in America are indistinguishable. Healthcare, so-called, may or may not be a right, but the healthcare reform was about one thing, and it was not healthcare for a nation of afflicted, addicted, media marketing addicted consumers. It was about retaining and extending the sick care cartel's share of the national income. The demographic realities of a shrinking workforce and rising body of retirees dooms the entire social welfare state idea. The conceit of the social welfare state, that the state can provide retirement and health care for 40% of its citizenry by heavily taxing another 40% who are working in tax-paying jobs as opposed to the casino tax economy, will be proven false. Proponents keep claiming that minor tweaking of parameters will make this idea work. Extend retirement age by a few years, increase the tax a few points, etc. But what they don't factor in is what Charles Hugh Smith calls the end of work. The truth is that minus credit bubbles and exponential expansions of credit to fuel consumption, frenzies and addictions, the post-industrial U.S. economy has no need for 130 million high-paid workers. just as America doesn't need any more houses, you already have 19 million vacant ones, or malls, or office towers. It also has no real work for people to do in these vacant malls and offices. The entire idea of a global empire based on dollar hegemony, feeding an endlessly expanding economy of consumption, extravagance, and excess, is bankrupt. Smith wrote a book called Survival Plus, which talks about a political financial system reaching its terminal stages by investing more and more to extract increasingly marginal returns. The power elites erect one facade and facsimile of reform after another, each one heralded as the fix the nation state or empire so desperately needs to return to the good old days of seemingly unlimited power and prosperity. All are shams, carefully designed and marketed simulacra of actual change. These monumental efforts at creating the illusion of reform have an immediate payoff. The power elites remain solidly in power, and their share of the nation's income and wealth actually increases as the majority of citizens sink deeper into various stages of poverty. Eventually, of course, the system comes apart at the seams because facades, illusions, and sham reforms have not actually fixed any of the marginal returns or fundamental problems eroding the system and empire. Eventually, the state and empire collapses. Do we cling so tightly to these ideologically appealing quasi-religious failed ideas because we fear not having any replacement ideas? Or do we cling to these failed ideas because we fear the decline of the power elites and the empire? Or is the real problem that we are just suffering from a grand failure of imagination? Well, something to think about, ladies and gentlemen. Over your coffee and cakes. You know, over the past several decades, one of the primary engines of economic prosperity in the U.S. has been a constantly expanding debt spiral. As long as the U.S. government, state governments, businesses, and American consumers could all continue to borrow increasingly large amounts of money, the economy was going to continue to grow, and the greatest party on earth could continue. But many of us did know that if anything ever came along and significantly interrupted that death spiral, it could cause a credit crunch even more severe than we saw at the beginning of the Great Depression back in the 1930s. You see, back in the roaring 20s, American businesses and consumers had leveraged themselves like never before. Debt soared to record levels, and when the credit spigot was suddenly turned off, the whole thing came crashing down, and it took an entire decade and a world war to recover. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have to tell you that today things are frighteningly similar. Over the past 30 years, we have piled up unprecedented mountains of debt. So, are we facing a credit crunch in 2010? I'm afraid so. Consumer credit in the United States has already contracted during 15 of the past 16 months, and there is every indication that things are about to get a lot worse. The truth is that once a deflationary cycle starts, it tends to feed on itself. People stop spending money, banks stop making loans, and everyone starts hoarding cash. And right now, there is a lot of fear out there. According to one major indicator, consumer sentiment declined in early July to its lowest in 11 months. U.S. consumers are starting to pay down debt and are holding on to their money. Others can't spend more money because they're out of work or completely tapped out. But without more spending, the U.S. economy won't get revved up again. And if the U.S. economy doesn't get going soon, there are going to be more foreclosures, more bankruptcies, and even more jobs lost. In a recent article for Britain's Daily Telegraph, Ambrose Evans Pritchard set out some of the statistics that show that the U.S. economy is in really, really bad shape right now, and I quote, "The U.S. workforce has shrunk by 1 million over the past 2 months as discouraged jobless give up the hunt. Retail sales have fallen for the past 2 months. New home sales crashed to 300,000 in May after tax credits ran out, the lowest since records began in 1963. Mortgage applications have fallen by 42% to 13-year lows since April. Paul Bales at Capital Economics said the shadow inventory of unsold properties has risen to 7.8 million. The double dip in housing has begun." End of quote. Seems like everyone's using the word double dip these days. It's almost as if it were already a foregone conclusion. But the truth is that this would have been just one long economic decline if the U.S. government and many other governments around the globe hadn't pumped so much stimulus into their economies over the past several years. Now that governments around the world are pulling back and are beginning to implement austerity measures, the sugar rush of the stimulus money is wearing off and the original economic decline is resuming. All of the trillions in stimulus did was to give the world economy a temporary boost and get us into a whole lot more debt. In his recent article entitled, "The U.S. is on the edge of a growing deflationary sinkhole," Lorimer Wilson did a really good job of detailing how all of this debt has gotten us into a complete and total mess. And I quote, "Capitalism cannot function unless its constantly compounding debt is serviced and or paid down. Today, the U.S., the world's largest debtor, can no longer pay what it owes except by rolling its debt forward and borrowing more in what the late economist Hyman Minsky called Ponzi financing, financing common in the final stages of mature capital systems. The amount of outstanding U.S. debt, according to Martin D. Weiss, has now reached levels that can never be paid off. The United States government and its agencies have by far the largest pile-up of interest-bearing debts, $15.6 trillion, the largest accumulation of unsecured obligations, over $60 trillion, the largest yearly deficit, $1.6 trillion, and the greatest indebtedness to the rest of the world, $4.8 trillion. The reality is that the United States is in the early stages of a truly historic financial implosion. Earlier this year, all of the focus was on the European sovereign debt crisis, but now all eyes are turning back to the U.S. once again. David Bloom, currency chief at HSBC, recently remarked that world financial markets are extremely concerned about the state of the U.S. economy right now, and I quote, "We're in a world of rotating sovereign crises. The market seems to become obsessed with one idea at a time, then violently swings towards another. People thought the euro would break up. Now we're moving into a new phase because we're hearing alarm bells of a U.S. double dip." End of quote. Without direct intervention from the U.S. government, the U.S. financial system is headed for a world of hurt. In fact, that the credit markets are freezing up and without efficiently operating credit markets, the economic system that has been constructed simply will not work. Well, you know, I can tell you these things, you know, any numbers of ways to Christmas, but quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen, the writing's on the wall. And you hear this from me every week, and all I can tell you is that you have no hope of getting this information from the regular media. It just won't come to you. They are simply not prepared to put themselves out on a line. So you're on your own, because your friends, relations, colleagues, you know, they're never going to get this information together. So, you know, good luck in passing it all and basically coming to your own conclusions. What can I say? All right, let's take one of Steve Kruger's rants, quite short, but to the point, as always. Steve Kruger says as follows, and I quote, "As usual, another good choice for weekend reading, Richard. When I went to public school, only the very brightest kids were bored, and they would chat and daydream, stare out of the window, wishing they were elsewhere. I started school in 1944, and as I moved up through the grades, I could see more and more kids showing signs of boredom. By the third grade, boredom had caught up with me. I went to public school up to the sixth grade. For the seventh and eighth grade, I went to private school. My boredom came to a screeching halt, as the private school was at least a year ahead of the public school. I tell you, Richard, Dad and few kids were staring out of the window in this school. When your parents play for your schooling out of pocket, you can bet your butt you will learn, or else you can count on a lot of grief from Mom and Dad. Today, I can see what's going on with my grandkids in public school. The whole class is bored to tears. And it's not just the kids. The teachers are bored also. Most of today's teachers are the product of public education, so they fail to realize the shallow education they are producing. Today, America's educational system is on a downward spiral. Over the years, the government's only solution to this is to push more taxpayer money at the education problem. As with our economy, the solution public school system is that there is no solution. With all the special interests that are involved, it is required that a total collapse occur, as no one will ever give back any control at all. I've come to find out that in life, the most unaffordable things are the things that are free. You get what you pay for. Also, something to think about is that some of the world's wealthiest people have not gone to or dropped out of college. I'm sure this is the exception to the rule and not the rule. If a lack of education was a prerequisite to financial success, then I would be in the top 10. Steve Kruger. Well, thank you, Steve. You know, I don't know, with all this thinking that goes on, you really should write a book. I'm really, very impressed with the things you say, and just keep them coming. I'm sure my listeners are too. In fact, I get lots of positive comments about your work, Steve, so let it keep coming, please. Just another one that you threw in here, Steve, and I quote, "Richard, talk about loans made to those least likely to repay them. I saw an article that said Fannie Mae was making loans in the under 150,000 class, and that 50% of loans in this class is to mobile homes. It is also little or nothing down. Mobile homes are just that, no land involved, and the house is on wheels. You fall behind on your payments, just drive it down the road or keep moving. Richard, I can't for the life of me recall who printed this, but it was in the last 2 weeks. You have to wonder what the hell they're thinking about making loans like this. Why not just throw the money away?" S.K., otherwise known as Steve Kruger. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, I suppose it's come time for our mid-break, so we will take it, and we will be right back.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
This is Mark Rudd, host of Doing the Spadework, an ongoing conversation about organizing, talking with a variety of organizers from around the country who are out there doing the spadework, who are building the basis for the coming social and political movement, what you might call the new civil rights movement. Please join us each week to hear good conversation every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. From material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hello, everybody. We're back. This is Richard Martin, and just got an email in from Penelope, who says, last week, you mentioned the wealthy Jordan Malone, who with his wife is considering moving to Canada if need be. I looked up the interview with him. I noticed that Jordan Malone said, quote, "We have a retreat that's right on the Quebec border. We own 18 miles on the border, so we can cross anytime we want to. We can get away. It would probably be illegal, but we could go," end of quote. The important thing to note is that he said it would probably be illegal. That made me think about what are the laws about moving to another country. You're always advocating moving to another country, but can we just move to another country and start living there? And does it matter if we are, one, going to be working, or two, going to be living on U.S. Social Security, or three, going to be living on savings? Thanks so much, Penelope. Well, Penelope, you can set your mind at rest. What I think, in fact, I'm 99% sure that John is referring to is the fact that, I guess, and I've never looked into this, but if you own property on the border with another country, you can't just sort of wander into the other country at will. You have to sort of go through the checkpoints, wherever they may happen to be. That's what I think he means by it being illegal. I think you're not really supposed to just dart across from one country to another. If you tried doing that in Mexico, you'd get shot. So I don't suggest that. I don't think you're going to get shot necessarily if you go into Canada, but you're running very serious risks, especially these days with the Department of Homeland Security and terrorism and all that kind of thing. So I don't recommend it, and I don't think John does either. But that's what I think he means when he says it's illegal. And if he used to drive around to the nearest checkpoint and check himself out of the United States through into Canada, don't think he's anything to worry about. Certainly, whenever you have nothing to worry about, there are no laws about moving to another country. You can just move, as I say, to another country and start living there. You do need, of course, a work or some kind of residence permit in your country of choice. That's a different matter altogether. That's something that you need to deal with your projected country. But the United States makes no demands on you in terms of living in the United States itself. It doesn't matter if you're going to be working or if you're going to be living on U.S. Social Security. You're still entitled to your Social Security wherever you live in the world. And likewise, your savings. You can live on your savings anywhere you wish. So nothing to worry about. Just bear in mind that you do need to plan these things. And, of course, that means that you've got to make certain arrangements which must be done in advance. From all sorts of different standpoints, and there are various websites which will help you do that. International Living is one, which I always recommend to people who are going to certain countries, because International Living is an American organization. It's a subsidiary of Agora Financial. I think it's its oldest subsidiary, by the way. And they have people stationed in various different countries to help you out. So you might just want to give them a call when you reach, or rather when you have decided on your target country, and get advice from them. They're supposed to be very good, very helpful, and very competent in their jurisdiction. So bear that in mind. They're called internationalliving.com. And by the way, while we're talking about leaving the country, there are more and more reasons every day that seem to be springing up. And one of them has just come to light. It's the health care bill, which mandates, according to numismaster.com, starting on January the 1st in 2012, federal law will require coin and bullion dealers to report to the Internal Revenue Service all gold and silver coin purchases and sales greater than $600. And that's not an error. That is what they're trying to do. It's what I think is the equivalent of what they did in the 30s, which is to try to confiscate it, because obviously the purpose of holding gold and silver is to make sure that it retains a profit over and above the U.S. dollar. But, of course, the government doesn't consider it a simple currency. It's considered a collectible. And so, therefore, they're going to tax it as an investment. And that's pretty much, to my way of thinking, another way of saying get rid of it. Because if you have it as an investment and you have to pay, you know, what I think it is, 20-something percent on that investment as a as an exceptional investment in precious metals, you know, it sort of takes away the a lot of the motive for having it in the first place. You know, they're just tacking stuff on wherever they can, and not only that, but as for your body, you'll be required to have an electronic health record by 2014. Did you know that? They sneaked that one into one of the stimulus bills. The electronic record will include an obesity rating. The information will be required to be on a national exchange with only secure access. I like that one. Why your obesity rating has to be on a national exchange is quite beyond me, but that's a tip-off to how micromanaged they're going to attempt to run your life. And keep in mind that the health bill and financial reform bill are thousands and thousands of pages long, with many of the details left up to the new agencies to fill in. Obama is appointing major league interventionists to head these agencies. They're completely clueless as to how an economy works. Their regulations will be over the top. It will stifle America in so many ways it's difficult to imagine. Anyone who's ever lived in a communist state can readily attest to what constant monitoring and that micromanagement do to people. It's not pretty. The gray, the drab, the despair is everywhere. When you can only take orders and wait for approvals and are constantly watched, it saps the life out of you. America, my friends, is going to be changing, and the government is going to try to watch you and monitor your vitals as if you were a lab rat. Watch it. That's all I can say. Word to the wise. Well, okay. I'd mentioned someone called Paul Craig Roberts before, several times. He's a particularly incisive commentator, and he's an economist and a nationally syndicated columnist for Creators Syndicate. He served as an assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, earning fame as a co-founder of Reaganomics. He is a former editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Business Week, and Scripps Howard News Service. Roberts has been a critic of both Democratic and Republican administrations. He has written or co-written 8 books, contributed chapters to numerous books, and has published many articles in journals of scholarship. He has testified before congressional committees on 30 occasions on issues of economic policy. In an interview with the Daily Bell, he had this to say, and I quote, "In recent years, there has been a redistribution of power in the U.S. from government to private. The U.S. now resembles an oligarchy of private interests. The most powerful ones are Wall Street, AIPAC, the military security complex, the oil industry, agribusiness, insurance, and pharmaceuticals. These private interests control economic and foreign policy, write the legislation that Congress passes and the President signs, and have achieved the monopolization of the U.S. economy by large-scale commercial organizations. As far as I can tell, traditional conservatives scarcely exist in the U.S. today. They have been eliminated by the neoconservatives, essentially militarists committed to U.S. world hegemony. The Republican Federalist Society has succeeded in enhancing the powers of the executive over the co-equal branches of government. Many federal judges and departments of justice appointments are drawn from the membership of the Federalist Society, thus putting in place ideologues to advance executive power. Once executive power becomes dictatorial, we will have lifetime rulers and growing conflict between the executive and private oligarchic interests. American elections are meaningless, as the vast majority of those elected are dependent or become dependent on the campaign contributions from the private oligarchic interests. Today, government bureaucracies, Child Protective Services and police, for example, have unaccountable power over private individuals, but the power of government over organized private interests has been beaten back. Today, the private interests rule the state. Examples of this are endless. President Obama broke his campaign promises and renewed America's aggression against Afghanistan because that was what the military security complex demanded. The healthcare reform was written by the private insurance companies and was designed to provide the insurance companies with 30 million involuntary new customers. Environmental restraints on deep water drilling were removed at the instruction of the oil industry, resulting, for example, in the extraordinary environmental destruction in the Gulf of Mexico. Wherever one looks, the external costs that private companies are able to impose on others are rising. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I told you the background to this gentleman. I mean, his credentials could hardly be more mainstream. And here's a man telling you that the powers that be are going to become dictatorial. And basically, what he's saying is, when he talks about lifetime rulers, that elections will be all but scotched. Well, if that isn't a reason enough to move out of the country, I don't know what is. I mean, you know, things are going to get so bad that it will be cruel of me to remind you that I told you that you should leave the country. It will simply be cruel. As if I were to now harp on and on about how I warned you and told you and begged you and cajoled you to sell your houses before the implosion of the housing market. Do you really want me to go on reminding you about that? Well, we are still at the stage in terms of residents in the United States of predicting the future. We haven't got to it yet, but we are rapidly arriving at that point, ladies and gentlemen. And I will go on talking about it until it happens, and then one day I'll just stop. Because it will then become cruel, and I don't really wish to, you know, turn the screws. You know, I told you so only goes so far. Well, Harvard professor and prolific author Neil Ferguson, that I've also mentioned on various occasions, opened the 2010 Aspen Ideas Festival on Monday with a stark warning about the increased prospect of the American empire suddenly collapsing due to the country's rising debt level. And he said, "I think this is a problem that's going to go live really soon. In that sense, I mean that within the next 2 years, because the whole thing fiscally and in other ways is very near the edge of chaos. And we've already seen in Greece what happens when the bond market loses faith in your fiscal policy. Ferguson said empires such as the former Soviet Union and the Roman Empire can collapse quite quickly, and the tipping point is often when the cost of servicing an empire's debt is larger than the cost of its defense budget. He said the U.S. is now deeply in the red as a country because of a combination of the Great Recession, the resulting federal stimulus, and financial bailout programs, two wars, the Bush tax cuts, and a growth in social entitlement programs. And economic debt can lead to a sudden loss of military power and global respect, Ferguson said, and I quote, by combating our crisis of private debt with an extraordinary expansion of public debt, we inevitably are going to reduce the resources available for national security in the years ahead. Because as a debt grows, so the interest payments you have to make on it grow, even if interest rates stay low. And on current projections, the federal debt is going to be absorbing around 20%, that's a fifth of all the taxes you pay, within just a few years. The item of discretionary federal expenditure most likely to be squeezed is, of course, defense. And there are lots of historic precedents for that. End of quote. Ferguson is also the author of Empire, the Rise and Demise of the British World Order and the Lessons for Global Power. So quite frankly, he is pretty much an expert on what happens to empires of one sort or another. David Gergen of CNN, who moderated the discussion, which also included billionaire Mortimer Zuckerman, asked Ferguson whether it made a difference if the U.S. declined as a world power. Ferguson's comment, having grown up in a declining empire, I do not recommend it. It's not a lot of fun, actually. Decline. All right. So now we come to an email from Frank, who says, Richard, on numerous occasions I have called the U.S. economy an ongoing crime. You probably all saw the movie The Sting. Well, folks, you're now living it. Don't look for Redford or Newman. We are the cast in this version. Instead of a few million, we are playing for trillions, a lifetime of onerous tax servitude for us, enslavement, and future generations if this crime continues. Better than Hollywood, it is Wall Streetwood. Don't hold your breath waiting for our media to explain this to the populace. If anyone reading this is anyone whose future they care about, maybe they should take the place of the silent media and let those uninformed folks know they are cast members in a big-time production. Richard, you were one of the first canaries in the mine, and if everyone knew you have helped would sign on to this thank you, this email would go on far too long. From the foxhole, Frank. Oh, Frank, thank you for that one. All right, well, I went to see my lawyer today. I was reading the Straits Times, and I was somewhat interested because Singapore has just come out with officially projecting the rate of growth at between 13 and 15% this year. As I mentioned on my Friday broadcast, I have not yet seen a flurry of people coming to me asking how they can get permits to come and live in Singapore, but I'm ready at the switch in case you do. The reason I mentioned this today is because there was a two-page article in the Straits Times entitled Welcome Surge, but Stay Focused on the Fundamentals. And they mention about 20 or 30 different people with their comments on this 13 to 15% projected rise. And, I'm just going to read you a couple here. I'm looking at the paper. There's one from François Lancon, who's president of Avaya Asia Pacific, who says, After the struggles of the global economic crisis, such news creates a positive environment for business in Singapore. Employers and job seekers are buoyed by the news. Confidence returns and opportunities open up. That's one, and it goes on. You know, the usual stuff which you come to know and love in the United States, I assure you, is not specific to your country. It seems to be everywhere you look. So I look for another one from A.R. Dinkaran, Managing Director of JG Enterprises, who says, from a business with interests deeply rooted in domestic spending and tourist spending to some extent, I am happy and look forward to the growth as it percolates through all sectors of the economy from the present exported-oriented sectors. I feel our growth in the future will come from more largely from improved productivity and efficiency only as we operate in a near-finite market with an aging population. Another one, then John Brell, Senior Vice President, Managing Director of Hill International. Singapore's 18.1% growth in the first half of 2010, the fastest in the world, is remarkable and welcome news coming from the dark days of the financial crisis. It is reassuring that the construction sector remained one of the strongest economic drivers, growing by as much as 13.5%. Ladies and gentlemen, this goes on and on, all these people. I mean, I just, you know, literally, I hadn't prepared this. I'm just looking at the newspaper, pages 12 and 13. But what I did prepare for you is out of, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 2, 3, 4, 24 commentaries. There is one comment that says what I believe to be the truth. And I don't follow what goes on in Singapore. I don't have time. Unfortunately, I spend so much time, you know, dealing with the United States that really we have to leave it there as far as, you know, what I can usefully become expert in. But I thought this was interesting. One comment out of 24, just one, from a Teng Yao Heng, Michael. You know, in this part of the world, people have two names. They have a Western name. In Teng's case, it's Michael, and a Chinese name, Yao Heng. So therefore, he's called Teng Yao Heng, because they put the last name first, and then they add the, you know, they usually put the Christian or the first name before the last name. So normally it would be Michael Teng Yao Heng, but he calls himself Teng Yao Heng Michael. So anyway, he's Michael Teng to you and me. This is what he's managing director of the Corporate Turnaround Center of Singapore, and this is what he says. Singapore's current rapid economic growth is not sustainable. I have cautioned twice since November 2008 in this column about the coming financial tsunamis. The second wave is from Europe, and it is now happening. We are currently seeing temporary relief with the various central banks' fiscal stimuli. But Singapore is very vulnerable to the vagaries of the global economy and will be impacted by the Eurozone crisis, which is imminent. The positive side is that the U.S. economy is recovering, though still fragile. Ladies and gentlemen, remind me to call this man and put him straight on that score. And Asia is on the growth path. The so-called recovery has created some optimism and sense of well-being in the marketplace. Consumers as well as companies are more willing to spend and invest in the future. However, it may give a false sense of hope that all is well, as this growth is not benefiting our small to medium-sized enterprises, because the labor costs and other overheads have escalated. Also, I am concerned that some have not learned the pitfalls of over-leveraging, as they are borrowing and spending again like there is no tomorrow, especially in the property sector, and will be badly hit when the second wave of financial tsunami does reach our shores. Well, you see, that's just the problem. If I was a Martian coming down from outer space and landing in Singapore, and I'm confronted with 23 people who are telling me that everything's going to be great, and one person who's telling me that things are going to be bad, who do you think I'm going to believe? You know, and that's the problem that we're having to deal with. When people who simply talk out of both sides of their mouth, as they know perfectly well that things are not going well. I mean, what this man said and what I read you is makes such perfect logical sense that, you know, if I was really not biased and I came from another part of the world, I would immediately question all of the other people on the basis of what I just read you from what this man said. And that's where we are in the States. It's the same thing. You know, the few people who talk out, like Paul Craig Roberts, that I just read you, who used to be, you know, as part, much a part of the mainstream as any other American today, and simply went over to the other side because he knew what a hoax the whole thing is. And that's what we're really having to deal with here. And I just urge you, as you keep getting told how much better things are, and of course in the case of Singapore, one of the little kind of twists here is that, of course, there could be a 13 to 15% increase theoretically, but from much, much lower levels that we saw in 2008, 2009 with the worldwide meltdown. So that's the kind of, you know, tricky part about this statistic, is that it doesn't tell you how bad things were before the recovery took hold. And always remember the statistic, which is that if you lose, 50% of any investment or statistical marker, you have to make 100% to get back there. So if you lose 50%, for example, and you make 13 to 15%, that's not a very big rise, is it? But, you know, who's going to tell you this? Well, oh, ladies and gentlemen, life goes on, but... you know, it's kind of rather sad. I was reading this article from the Wall Street Journal about, it is entitled Back to the Stone Age, where they're talking about paved roads, historical emblems of American achievement are being torn up across rural America and replaced with gravel or other rough surfaces as counties struggle with tight budgets and dwindling state and federal revenue. This is the sort of thing we're going to have to be looking forward to, I suppose. Going back to the 30s and 40s before they put down, you know, asphalt on the roads. It's back to basics here, I guess. And then they'd say state money for local roads was cut in many places amid budget shortfalls. In Michigan, at least 38 of the 83 counties have converted some asphalt roads to gravel in recent years. Last year, South Dakota turned at least 100 miles of asphalt road surfaces to gravel. Counties in Alabama and Pennsylvania have begun downgrading asphalt roads to cheaper chip and seal road, also known as poor man's pavement. Some counties in Ohio are simply letting roads erode to gravel. I didn't think I'd ever see that, but, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the real problem for the United States, I would like to remind you, is not really that it's going to get so much worse than other countries. The real problem in the United States is that it got so much better than other countries for so many years. It reached pinnacles of success that were undreamt of 60, 70 years ago.